This episode of Stage 9 is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
You're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Stage 9, Trek FM show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today, you know, and we said that we were going to talk about Dark Tower, but we are going to discuss it for a little bit, which was...
Now, as somebody who has read The Gunslinger, I read it years and years ago when I was much younger, and I reread it because I was going to read it and then go see the movie. Have you read The Gunslinger, any of The Gunslinger books?
No. In fact, I knew next to nothing about this movie going into it. Or this story.
Do you think that, because one of the things that I did read in the multitude of negative reviews was that a lot of the world building, et cetera, was convoluted and unclear. Do you agree with that, or did it work acceptably as a film?
No, I would agree that it was convoluted and unclear. Yeah.
Okay.
I guess we should preface this by saying that the reason why we're discussing this is because the movie was co-written by Akiva Goldsman, who is an executive producer and writer and director on the new Star Trek show, Discovery. And, yeah, I think his involvement sort of like started because Ron Howard was going to direct this years ago. And Ron Howard is a producer on the film. And we know that Ron Howard and Akiva Goldsman are buddy-buddy, you know, having worked together on, I think, 4 movies in the past.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, okay, like, I literally knew nothing about this. I knew that it was, like, a series of books, like, a series of rather short books, which was kind of a unique thing for King. And I remember when they came out.
Yeah, I think that the first 3 were relatively short, but then... I made it as far as the 4th book. I made it a quarter of the way through the 4th book, and the 4th book became a, you could say, a stereotypical Stephen King tome. Mm-hmm. And that's why by a quarter of the way through, I just basically said, I'm out. So
yeah. You know, it's a weird thing because you hear Stephen King and you think a certain type of thing. And... I literally knew nothing about this. I knew that Matthew McConaughey and Idris Elba were in it. I knew that Idris Elba was playing the gunslinger, and I was aware of the gunslinger as a character from, you know, more than anything, like the poster that Drew Struzan did for the fake movie in The Mist.
Oh my gosh, was that... Jeez, it's been so long since I saw The Mist.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
And it was one of those things where, like, I went to the theater and, like, the movie starts and I'm like, oh, it's this type of movie. Oh, there's, like, you know, other worlds, other planes of existence and, like, literal dark towers, like, in the center of universes and stuff. And I'm like, I was not quite expecting this, and I wasn't expecting like a kid as the protagonist or any of these things, and it really made me sort of like alter my viewing of the movie, I guess, in a sense, because it wasn't at all what I was expecting. Really, I guess I didn't really know what I was expecting.
One of the things that I read, and I have no idea if this is true, but this was a charge leveled in one of the reviews, was, or, you know, and I only read like the intro paragraphs or whatever, but, you know, the stuff pulled from Metacritic and everything like that, was that this was envisioned as launching a television series.
Well, it still is. They just announced
Glenn. This is going to launch a television series?
Yeah, the television, I think the original plan, like way back in the day, was like Ron Howard was going to be the mastermind behind all this, and it was going to start with a movie, I think, or it might have started with a television series, which was going to like lead up to them. Like, it was something, it was either one or the other, I can't remember, but basically like the TV show would premiere in the fall, and then play until the summer, and then the movie would come out in the summer, or the movie would come out in the summer, and then the TV show would come out in the fall. One or the other, you know, and then it was sort of going to like bounce back and forth between the two. And I think they've toned down the plans a bit, but there is a prequel Dark Tower show, and they just announced this week that Glenn Mazzara, the guy who replaced Frank Darabont on The Walking Dead, he's going to be the showrunner on that. And
at this point, it's almost impossible to find somebody that hasn't produced some property tied to Stephen King in some way.
Yeah. It's weird though. Like, it really felt to me like a sort of like teen sci-fi movie, like one of these Twilight, you know, Hunger Games type of things. Like, that's how it felt.
So this is supposed to be basically the end of the story, and then the TV series is going to tell everything leading up to it.
Is that correct?
Well, you just said it's a prequel TV show.
Yeah, but I don't know how. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what the books are or whatever. I mean, I can tell you that this basically starts with like a kid in New York who is having like dreams, and then he gets thrust into this other world.
That's from a later book. Okay, you meet a kid in the first book, and I'm treading lightly. The first book is not exactly a masterwork. It's not something that I would put up in, you know, the shelf of this is one of the greatest things that Stephen King ever wrote, but it has the virtue of being different and outside of his wheelhouse. So if you're a Stephen King fan, it's appealing from that regard. But there is a kid that you meet in the first book, but you come to find out that he has died in what we would consider our world to come to life in Roland's world, the gunslinger. And that's how they cross paths. But there is, I haven't read the other two, the, you know, second and third book in many years, but I believe that the kid who consciously comes from the other, from our world, is from, I think, the third book, maybe the tail end of the second, because the third book is the drawing of the three, which is talked about in the first book, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, it sounds like they're kind of mushing things together here then. I'm not sure, but it really did sort of play, you know, almost like, you know, I mean, like one of these, you know, kind of like coming of age sci-fi fantasy things where it's like the kid, you know, is thrown into, I mean, Star Wars, I guess, is what it is. You know, this kid is thrown into this world unexpectedly, but he has powers and he's going to be the one who can blah, 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 you know? Mm-hmm. And I don't know, like from the very beginning, I was kind of like, what? Like it literally starts off with like a like text on a black background saying like, the Dark Tower, you know, resides at the center of the universe. It is said that the mind of a child can destroy it. And I'm thinking like, oh, that's, you know, they're speaking metaphorically, right? And then like the very next thing, like you see like these kids being strapped into a machine and then like their minds shoot out like a laser bolt across the galaxy and, you know, try to destroy this tower. And I'm like, oh, they literally meant that. Okay. You know, and I don't know, like, it's bad. It's as bad as people are saying in a lot of ways.
Really?
I mean, I don't know. Maybe not as bad as people are saying, but it's bad. And part of it is that it feels cheap. And another part of it is that the story is, you know, sort of like cutesy and everything. And, you know, I don't know. There's a whole segment where, like, and I don't know if this is in the books or whatever, I'm sure it is, but like basically after hanging out in Roland's world for an extended period of time, they then need to travel back to New York City. And basically Roland is on Earth with the kid now. And it's like the roles are sort of reversed because now he's, you know, Roland is a fish out of water. It's very kind of Star Trek 4-ish, you know, where like he gives him a can of Coke and he's like, what is this? You know, or, oh my God, these painkillers are amazing. I haven't felt this good in years, you know, things like that. Mm-hmm. And it's like that stuff I thought was, you know, kind of charming, you know, but I mean, the action is not very well choreographed or shot. There's, you know, certain things that happen where you're like, there's like they literally missed point B when going from A to C in this action beat, you know, stuff like that. You know, it's
do you think that it's victim of they had a longer cut, they saw they had a stinker, so they cut it down to an hour and a half to get as many showings in the opening weekend as they could?
No, I don't think so. No. I think that it had problems beyond that. And yeah, I mean, I don't know. You know, I mean, it's this weird thing that's happening though, where I've seen numerous articles, like at least two full-fledged articles and numerous other like tweets from various critics placing the blame on Akiva Goldsman, right? Because I think he's an easy person to place blame on.
Yeah, know? Well, but he's only one name attached to this.
Yeah, it's not four, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he co-wrote it with his, you know, sort of like semi-regular co-writer, Jeff Pinkner, who, you know, worked on Fringe with him. He was the showrunner on Fringe. He was the showrunner on Alias and everything. And then there's a couple of other people who, you know, it looks like maybe wrote a separate draft at some point. I don't know. It's weird. I mean, yes, I understand that he has a reputation, you know, and he's not helping himself, I guess, by, you know, allying himself with the Transformers, you know, writer's room, which, by the way, there's a lot of people in that room. And, you know, yes, this movie said story by Akiva Goldsman, you know, the last Transformers movie, but I really get the impression that he did not. You know, like Zach Penn, you know, another very well-established writer who's, you know, he's writing Ready Player One now. And, you know, he was in that room and he said, you know, the Transformers writer's room disbanded 2 years ago after we worked together for 2 weeks. You know, it was literally just like kind of a jam session of a bunch of writers in order to come up with a bunch of ideas so that, you know, certain people could go off and write scripts, right? It's like get a bunch of people in a room, say, what if we did this? What if we did that? Oh, yeah, that's a good idea. And, you know, he came up with one of those, but it's not like he wrote the freaking movie himself. I don't know. You know, it's just like, I don't know.
I think it's residual, because I think that you have people now who are writing the articles and dissecting things who remember Batman and Robin. And I mean, seriously, Akiva Goldsman has, you know, for many years carried this like pariah status, yeah, along with Joel Schumacher because of his involvement with that film. And you and I have both talked about, you know, like you helped me come around to the point of like, yeah, you know what? It's kind of unfair. He's, you know, he's a talented guy. It was, you know, early in his career. Let's give him a break here. But I don't know. I'm willing to go out on a limb and say I think that's residual. I think that contributes to people picking on him. Is I think it's almost subconscious at this point.
Yeah.
Where they don't even realize that's why they're going after him.
And there are people who, you know, have been like, I saw someone online say like, we want Akiva Goldsman to continue to work on Transformers movies so that he doesn't touch any of these other franchises that we actually care about. You know, like things like that. And it's like, what has he done which has been so bad that, you know, he deserves this level of like hatred? Like there are so many writers out there who are way worse than him, you know, or filmmakers or anything. I mean, they'll even like, you know, like certain movies, like the, you know, I read, you know, one article where they went through his entire career and, you know, just like movie by movie saying like this one sucked, this one sucked, this one sucked. But even then, they didn't have that many that they really hated. And then whenever they came across one that was good, they were like, eh, you know, everyone writes a good movie every once in a while.
And that's, it's like, not, that is, no. That is demonstrably false.
That is
not everyone does.
True at all. You know, it's really freaking hard to write a movie, you know, let alone a good movie. And the fact that this guy has written numerous good movies is kind of amazing. You know, I mean, the fact that anybody does that. But, I mean, yeah, okay, so he has some stinkers, for sure. Dark Tower is one of them. Rings, which came out earlier this year, is another one, which is not good. But, you know, I don't know. Like, I mean,
he's doing something right because people still want to work with him.
Yeah, you
so
know.
So somebody doesn't blame him for it.
And, you know, I mean, I don't know. Like, because they kept on saying that, like, in this one article, is like, how does he keep on getting work when there are much better writers than him who don't, you know? How is it that he's able to trick, you know, studios into giving him millions of dollars to write garbage? And, I mean, I don't see that. I mean, like, for one thing, I think it's a lot more, it has to do with, like, personal relationships, personal working relationships. It's like, yes, he and Ron Howard are on the same wavelength, so they keep on working together. I'm sure that's how he ended up on Dark Tower, because Dark Tower was, like, Ron Howard's baby for years. And, yes, if Ron Howard wants someone to write his, you know, tentpole movie, he's going to turn to Akiva Goldsman, because Akiva Goldsman won him an Oscar, you know? And then he did Cinderella Man with him after that, and then he did the Da Vinci Code thing, you know? And it's like, I just don't get
it. It's just like a director gets people that are comfortable. You know, Justin Lin working with the same people, they understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
I'm looking for this like we did over here. Oh, yeah, I gotcha.
Right. So, I don't know. But it makes me, like, it's just weird that there is so much, you know, like, sort of negativity directed this dude's way. And I know it's been that way since 1997, because I remember it in 1997, you know? But, I don't know. It makes me want to revisit, like, one of his really, really solid movies to just kind of be like, hey, guys, remember when he did this? Like, I think we should cover Cinderella Man at some point.
Yeah, yes. I will totally be down with that because, quite frankly, you know, I guess because it's a boxing movie, I feel comfortable saying this. Pound for pound, I'll throw it up against just about anything.
Yeah.
And that movie is incredible. And, yeah, fine. We'll cover it. We will cover it at some point in the future.
Sounds good. But, yeah, I mean, Dark Tower, I mean, all that being said, Dark Tower is not a good movie. I don't necessarily blame Goldsman any more than anyone else. The direction is pretty terrible. I don't know. But there is one thing which I want to ask you about, and it took me like a good, you know, two-thirds of this movie to realize this. You know, they kept on talking about how the kid has the shine or has a shine or something like that. And the whole time, every time they said that, I was like, that's a really cheesy term. Like, this is ridiculous, goofy, whatever. And then, like, about two-thirds in the way through, I'm like, oh, like The Shining.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. And then I started thinking about how, like, all of, like, King's books, from what I understand, are connected in some way or another, and how I've heard things about how, like, Michael Clark Duncan's character from The Green Mile, like, also has The Shining. And so, like, that's it? Like, he's got The Shining, like, the same Shining that, you know, the little kid in The Shining had?
It's not explicitly said in the first three books, I don't think. But I can tell you that one of the key threads, and granted, I only made it a quarter of the way through the fourth book years ago. But I remember that started losing me because, like, the fabric of reality was frayed. And so they're walking through the world and stuff from King's other books started bleeding. Like, the whole idea is that the realities had started bleeding together.
Oh,
and so they see a headline and it makes a reference to Captain Trips, which is from The Stand, which is a phenomenal book, as I remember. And I'm terrified to go back and read it because I also had very fond memories of The Gunslinger. And I'm terrified I'm going to go back and read The Stand. And it's going to stink. And I'm going to be like, no. But, so, you know, there are these little tidbits. So basically the fabric of reality, blah, blah, universes crisscross, blah, blah, that sort of thing.
That's pretty cool. I like that. That makes me want to read that book more. But there are various Stephen King references in this movie, but I feel like they were more just kind of cutesy things. Like, you see, like, two twin girls, and they're, like, just doing some sort of rhyme where they're like, come play with us, you know? Like, there's that kind of thing. At one point, you know, there's a poster of Rita Hayworth hanging up on a wall. You know, little things like that, but...
Yeah, that definitely sounds like an element from the later books that was brought in for the sake of this, especially if the series is going to be a prequel to... But if Glenn Mazzara is producing, I'll definitely give it a shot, because I like what he does.
Yeah, I'm intrigued to see what they do. It'll be intrigued to see... I mean, I read a thing today, now they're saying it might be a different continuity, you know, who knows... They might try to distance themselves from this movie after it sort of bombed at the box office.
It opened at number one, thank you very much.
Did it? Oh, okay.
It did. It beat out Dunkirk by like $2 million, which, you know, darn it.
Yeah. Well, you know, Dunkirk has had its day.
And, had more weeks at number one than Spider-Man did.
And month. Yeah. No, it's true. It's a good movie. Dunkirk is a good movie. You know it's a great movie, which is out right now. Just kind of going off topic for a second.
What's that?
Atomic Blonde. If you're looking for something cool,
couldn't talk the missus into going to see that.
Okay. Well, you know, check it out. It's good. It's really good. So
cool.
Great soundtrack too. You know. Anyway.
Cool.
Anyway. So okay. Let's move on, shall we?
Let's do it.
Okay. One other little tidbit that was in the news, which I wanted to bring up. From the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, there is an article entitled Franklin Park Native Takes the Helm on Star Trek Discovery. And it is an article about how Gretchen Berg, who's from Pittsburgh, is one of the showrunners on Discovery. And, you know, they kind of get into the whole history with Brian Fuller leaving and all that stuff. And, you know, they have a number of quotes from Berg herself. But one of the things which I found to be really interesting, and we were talking about this over on The Edge the other day, because, you know, Goldsman and a number of other creators were at Star Trek Las Vegas, and all of them talked about how they were such big Star Trek fans, like Goldsman having, you know, gone to his first convention in 1976, you know, things like that. And one of the things which Amy asked was, do you think these people are genuine in their love of Star Trek, you know? Or do you think some of them are maybe just saying this because they're in a room full of Trekkies and they want to make it out alive, you know? Like, I'm a huge fan. And you know, I mean, I think there was some of that going on. I mean, Goldsman, you could tell. Goldsman, huge fan, right? Like, top to bottom, huge Trekkie. And, you know, we were talking about on that last episode of The Edge that came out last week, like, are there any people who aren't fans of Star Trek on the writing staff? And it turns out that there are. You know, right here in this article, it says, the pair, whose previous work includes Revenge, GCB, and Pushing Daisies, were recruited by Fuller to join Discovery's writing staff in mid-2016. At the time, Miss Burke said she had not watched an episode of Star Trek since she was in the third grade, but she said the writer's room included a mix of Trek fans and non-fans. So there you go. I mean, I don't know about Harbert's, but it is interesting to hear that she hadn't seen Star Trek since the third grade.
Good.
Yeah.
That means you've got a writer in the room, at least one, that isn't, you know, and it isn't bound by quote unquote canon, isn't going to limit themselves immediately about what they can pitch because of what they've seen before, you know, like they're not going to say, oh, well, we've seen this, but like they're going to think a little bit more outside the bounds than say a diehard Trekkie sits down and says, well, let's do it. No, we can't do that because Khan was over here at this, you know, like good.
Yeah,
that's good.
Nicholas Meyer was in the same boat, right? I mean, he hadn't seen anything. One kind of interesting quote. Now, this is back in 2016, August of 2016, so when Fuller was still around. But she said, I take it very seriously that people love the show as much as they do. I have my things that I'm like, I don't know if I trust you running with that. I'm glad Brian is in charge, and we're really glad to be there. So I kind of think that that is one of the they talked about like bringing in Goldsman because Bergen Harberts had never been in charge of a show of this scale, you know, by themselves before, and you know, Goldsman had the experience on things like Fringe in order to sort of like give them the support that they needed in order to, you know, make sure that things ended up the way that they did. But I'm wondering how much of it was also the fact that Goldsman was a massive Star Trek fan and that they knew that they needed someone who at least had some sort of passing familiarity with the franchise in order to make sure that it was, you know, it
right.
Fit.
They weren't trying to send people off in hyperspace
right.
instead of warp.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think that it's kind of cool that they have so many people in that room that are such huge Trek fans, and yet that's obviously not a requirement of the job since the people
yeah.
actually running it aren't, you know?
And it reminds me yet again of the fact that there was an article where somebody asked Meyer about working. No, they asked Fuller at the time because Fuller was still on the show about Meyer's involvement. And he said that, you know, the diehard fans would start going down a rabbit hole and Meyer would be the one to say, okay, guys, let's pull it back here. Let's get back to the story. Let's not get down in those weeds right now.
Right.
So,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. It's interesting. I don't know. Like we're really close to this thing coming out now and there's been a lot more information coming out and it seems like a lot of the people's fears about the whole canonical nature and its place in Star Trek and everything, like a lot of those fears are unfounded. And yet I feel like it's not going to be a problem either. Like it's not like this is a show which is meant to be a gap filler. I feel like, you know, hearing that Berg and I'm not sure about Harberts, but you know, one of the showrunners of this show is not a Star Trek fan, makes me think like, and I mean, it's never like I doubted this, but it's not like she was like, oh, this will be so great how this will fit in between these other two things. She's just like, whatever, we're telling a story, you know, very similar to what Meyer did with Wrath of Khan, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know.
Exactly.
It's cool. Exciting stuff.
It is. It's very exciting stuff.
Well, it's been fun talking about, you know, Akiva Goldsman on the Dark Tower and Gretchen Berg on Discovery, but that's not all we're talking about here on Trek FM this week, so here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Warp 5.
I just thought, you know, those are where, of course, some of the other Enterprise references come up. He was a Mako. He fought in the Zindian-Romulan Wars. I really like that background and that tie-in. And it makes sense that, you know, over the course of 100 years, that somebody's going to kind of go a little crazy and, you know, get to this point where they're just, you know, seething for some kind of revenge or something. So
the Ready Room.
Of all the things people to wonder about and question and be concerned about canon and visual canon on Discovery, the Klingons haven't concerned me that much because I think the Klingons are ripe and long overdue for, you know, for lack of a better term, some species diversity. And one of the things that Star Trek is prey to, and people acknowledge it, but still, we wish it wasn't a limiting factor, was TV budgets.
The 602 Club.
That emotional core, and I tie that too with the mentors that Peter doesn't have throughout the film. There's nobody there to pick up that Uncle Ben slack.
And introducing The Edge, a Star Trek Discovery podcast.
What have you done out there on the edge of Federation space?
Welcome to The Edge, Trek FM's brand new podcast where we dive into the final frontier of the newest Star Trek series, Star Trek Discovery, the first Star Trek series to be on air in 12 and a half years, something like that.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
check out these shows and discover what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You'll find them wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on your iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or, you know, on the iTunes app on the desktop. And you can get the latest episodes as soon as they're published if you do that. And please leave us a star rating and a review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and in most third-party apps. And you can stream and download the MP3 from our website or grab the RSS link as well. If you want to contact us, you can find us on the Babel Conference, which is our listener group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, and we should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can go to trek.fm/contact and select Stage 9, and that'll send a message right to us. Or you can find the network on Twitter at TrekFM or on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. John, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, you can find me as Kessel Junkie on your social network of choice. You can find me co-hosting Words with Nerds with my pal Craig. And over on the Nerd Party, you can find me co-hosting Aggressive Negotiations, a Star Wars podcast with Matthew Rushing. And you can also find me on Great Shot Kid, a Star Wars creators and technical podcast with a lovely co-host by the name of Mike Schindler.
Yes, you can find me over there on Great Shot Kid, and you can also find me on CommentaryTrackStars.com doing Commentary Track Stars, or you can find me on TalkFilmSociety.com doing Soderbergh 2828. And right here on Trek.fm, you can find me on a show called The Edge, which is all about Star Trek Discovery. And you can find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. We'd like to thank our associate producers today, Norman C. Lau, Jeff Sutter, and Chris Steftenagel.
Thank you.
Yeah, you know, I was so disappointed because, you know, it was as soon as we finished recording last week's episode, right? It was Friday afternoon. I had just gotten back into town less than 12 hours before. And, you know, I was in Vegas and I get a message from Chris. And he's like, "Hey, you're in Vegas, right? You want to meet up at some point?" And I'm like, "Oh, I'm gone now. I didn't know you were there." You know, it would have been fun to meet one of our associate producers. And then he's like, "I think I saw you. Were you wearing a White Sox cap and a White Sox shirt?" And I'm like, "Yeah. That was me."
Yes. That's
if anyone ever sees anyone at a Star Trek convention wearing a White Sox cap, chances are it's me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was disappointing, but we thank Chris nonetheless for his support, as well as Jeff and Norm. And if you want to be like Chris and Jeff and Norm, head on over to patreon.com/trekfm and become a patron of the network. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you can get all of the details on becoming a patron. Perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, and more available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month, and we really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. All right. Well, short episode this week, but you know, sometimes it's good to be short, like The Dark Tower. Yeah. I was very appreciative of that movie only being an hour and a half long.
But we're better than that, yes.
I hope so, but I mean, who are we to say, right? Yeah. We're shorter at the very least, so
yes, that. That's yeah. True.
All right. Well, I guess that's it for this week. I think we shouldn't say what's next week because we never end up doing whatever it is we say we're doing. So, yeah, let's just not say it. Let's let people guess.
Wasn't there some show on TV where they always said what the next episode was going to be, and then it was never that?
I'm not sure. Next week we'll be talking about Buckaroo Banzai versus the World Crime League.
Works for me.